purely GMO corn versus non-GMO corn, or is it possible that they've substituted other things other than corn in general for some of the sugar content?
Well, I used to have a regular bowl of grits for breakfast, and it was made by what was the company? Quaker grits. And I called them, and as a matter of fact, they told me that they do use GMO corn. And then I switched over to Wheatena, which is a part of the non-GMO project. They have a little sticker on the box that identifies it. And I'm not diabetic, but I have I do a regular blood sugar check after my meals, and I noticed with the GMO grits, I get quite a bit of overshoot until my blood level, the sugar level, came back. And with the Wheatena, which is part of the non-GMO project, I didn't get that. Now, it might be that it is a different food altogether, but anyway, it might just be me, okay?
Okay, no problem, John. I was just personally curious whether it had the same percentage of corn, because, again, corn fructose is not the greatest source of carbohydrates. And I think a lot of the problem has kind of gotten worse. Over about 20, 30 years, the corn lobby has been really pushing corn-based sugar at the cost of cane sugar, which tended to be a little bit more expensive and sometimes was farmed outside of the United States and such. So I think that's part of the problem as well. But I was just curious that way. To EO, you wanted to say something.
Yes, Roy. I have diabetes, and I know diabetes is an epidemic proportion today. I heard something or read something, I don't know where, that corn syrup is not digested like sugar cane. And it said that some researchers think that corn syrup, because it's not digested properly in the body, is the cause of the epidemic proportion of diabetes. What do you think, Roy? What's your opinion?
I think, like all things, it's not 100% yay or nay. It's somewhere in the middle. Corn syrup is what's called a high fructose. It's a slightly different type of sugar than you get in cane sugar. And I tend to think that the body is a little bit confused when they find high concentrations of it. And I would tend to agree that it's one of the causes for the growing obesity and the growing problems maintaining internal sugar levels that basically diabetes is. So I would think that, yeah, it's part of the problem. It's not all of the problem. If we just made corn syrup illegal, I don't think all the diabetics would become healthy and normal and not be overweight, but I think it would help a lot. But you have a big corn lobby who's been pushing ethanol-based gasoline and high fructose corn syrup for many, many years.
Okay, boy. We know what they say. Follow the money.
Unfortunately, that's the nature of humanity. We tend to be greedy creatures, and if they give you good stuff that's worth the money, then that's fine. That's capitalism. I'm all for it. It's when you go around and you monopolize and you pay people off and you cut corners and hide stuff and pay other people to do studies that kind of point people in the other direction, that it gets rather annoying. But I think there is a place for regulation and capitalism simultaneously. And maybe these companies shouldn't be giving such big campaign monies away. You know, maybe we should kind of limit that because politicians might be altering their attitudes based on how much money they get for their campaigns. But this is not the political net, and we won't discuss it really, but that's human nature.
Oh, I agree with you, boy. Capitalism is a great thing, but it does need regulations so it doesn't run wild. Socialism is not good. Certainly, communism doesn't work at all. So I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Again, this isn't the political net. The political net meets after 12:07 this morning on this repeater. I think what we really have is a mixed economy, and most people would agree that there's a degree of socialism. You have said how much you love Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the New Deal, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. All those things are kind of socialized. So we have a mixed economy, a little bit of socialism, a lot of capitalism, thankfully no communism.
That's why, and to me, oh, I guess you listen to me. I did like Frank Roosevelt before my time, but I think he was excellent. Two of my other presidents who I really loved were Harry Truman, who used to say the buck stops here, and of course, JFK.
Well, Richie, that's a very good selection, and I'll give you a special science talk puzzler for Harry S. Truman. You realize it was Harry S. Truman. So my question to you tonight, my little puzzler for you, is what did the S stand for?
M1YDY with a guess.
Feel free.
Nothing. I think it was just an initial.
That man a gold star. Yes, indeed. Harry Truman, God love him. He was, you know, they didn't expect anything from him. He was in the shadow of a great man, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he was a machine politician. Everyone was sort of amazed when he got up and he manned up. And it's probably politically incorrect to say manned up, but nevertheless, the buck stopped there, and he was a great president. I would agree with Rich about that. But Harry just picked it just had that S. It stood for absolutely nothing. Very good. So maybe everyone will stay tuned after 12:07 for the political net, but if they don't, I'll drop for a second, and then I'll go on to another story. This is AC2GS. Okay, things are really getting stranger and stranger at NASA these days. Now Dick has mentioned this, the talk that the Vice President Pence gave at Huntsville. Now, my recollection is this was a talk he gave back in March. And matter of fact, we actually did cover it at the time where he made these semi-outlandish promises of all these great things, and the NASA bureaucracy spent the next 6 weeks running all over the place, kind of writing up plans and going to the Senate and Congress asking for more money for it. But as far as I'm aware, that was going on in March. Let me drop and I'll tell you what NASA is doing these days. Okay, starting as early as next year, NASA says it will be making the International Space Station available to space tourists and other business ventures. Now, it sounds exciting, but the associated costs are a bit far beyond what most of you can afford, unless you're holding out on me. NASA doesn't fully own the ISS, nor is the space agency currently capable of independently delivering astronauts to orbit, but that's not stopping them from opening the space station to the commercial sector. In an announcement made earlier this past week, NASA's chief financial officer, Jeff DeWitt, said the space agency is making the space station available to business ventures and private astronauts, quote, as we've never done before, end quote, as reported by Yahoo News. Many companies already use the ISS to conduct commercial research and development, but the new effort is intended to broaden the scope even further and include other activities such as space tourism, as NASA explained in a press release. NASA said the private ISS flights will start as early as 2020, if you believe that, with missions lasting up to 30 days. A stay aboard the hotel ISS, however, will not come cheap, with the New York Times reporting the cost to be approximately $35,000 per night. Broken down, that's $22,500 for access to supplies, an additional $11,250 for stuff like water, oxygen, and use of the toilets, and $50 per gigabyte when using the station's data downlink, as per a new NASA directive. Extrapolate these costs over 30 days, and the bill suddenly ramps up to over $1 million. And because each short-duration stay will include four seats, more math tells us that NASA could earn as much as $4.2 million per mission. Let me drop for a sec. That said, NASA will only do this twice a year, so its profits are actually limited. The real reason for doing this is to work towards the privatization of the space station and to free up resources as it plans for its apparent 2024 moon mission. NASA also said that it won't be involved with the shuttling of tourists to the space station. Private entities will have to charter a flight with a commercial space flight solution currently being developed under NASA's Commercial Crew Program. As it stands, that means booking a flight with SpaceX or Boeing, both of which are currently developing crew modules, although with some difficulty in the case of SpaceX. The New York Times is reporting that Bigelow Aerospace has already reserved four launches with SpaceX, and Axiom Space, which wants to fly tourists to the ISS next year, is planning to do the same. And if you thought that the nightly rate of the ISS was expensive, it's nothing compared to the cost of getting there. A BBC post claims that the cost per flight could be as high as $60 million, which is the same price NASA will need to pay to send its own astronauts to orbit. Finally, NASA won't be vetting the incoming crew. Again, that will fall upon the companies themselves, who will need to make sure that the prospective private astronauts meet NASA's medical standards and the training and certification procedures for the International Space Station crew members. So, for, say, at the ISS, not only do you need to be rich, you basically need to be as fit and trained as a real astronaut. Good luck with that. Let me drop for a second, and I will continue. Interestingly, among the other new policies announced today, NASA will make one space station port, along with its associated utilities, available for vendors to attach their own commercial modules, which they'll use to conduct their various activities. Sadly, companies won't be able to do whatever they want up there, like set up an extraterrestrial escape room, as they have to follow NASA's rules. Now, as noted, NASA doesn't own the ISS. It's a cooperative program involving Europe, Russia, Canada, Japan, and the United States, and it functions under a set of international agreements. It's not immediately obvious that the United States can suddenly privatize the station or do whatever they want with it. A quote, it will be very hard to turn the ISS into a truly commercial outpost because of the international agreements that the United States is involved in, end quote. Frank Slazer, the vice president of Space Systems for Aerospace Industry Association, told Washington Post back in 2018, quote, it's inherently always going to be an international construct that requires U.S. government involvement and multinational cooperation, end quote, he told the Post. Indeed, it will be quite some time, if ever, before the private sector fully occupies the ISS. Still, this past week's announcement strongly suggests that NASA is taking a step back from the ISS-related activities as it focuses on the pending moon mission. Let me drop for a second, and I'll be back. This might be just one of NASA's ideas for funding all those sudden new moon missions, but it might not be necessary. Just the other day, the president tweeted out, quote, for all the money we are spending, NASA should not be talking about going to the moon. We did that 50 years ago. They should be focused on the much bigger things we are doing, including Mars, parenthesis of which the moon is a part, end parenthesis, defense and science, end quote. So, if NASA's vacation package never comes to fruition, but you still want to spend a lot of money, may I remind you that Apple is selling a delightful new computer monitor for only $6,000. And it doesn't come with a stand. If you want a stand for the darn thing, that's another $1,000. Still, it'll be a lot less expensive than a space ride. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Seth Bigelow has plans on getting involved. They had plans and still have plans of having their own space station. You know, they want to launch something called the Bigelow 330 cubic meter spacecraft. You know, an inflatable thing. I mean, that's one of their long-term goals. So that would be independent from the space station. That's the only way they could do it without any of these agreements between Russia and the other countries that are involved with the ISS. So, I mean, maybe they'll do that, but I'm not sure what. I know Bigelow at one time wanted to attach another inflatable to the space station. Maybe that's it. They've already done one. You know, they have a 500 square meter beam, they call it the Bigelow expandable activity module attached to the space station. And they wanted to put a bigger one up. So maybe that's it. Maybe they plan on putting one of those up, you know, one of their big ones.
Yes, Paul. It's probably NASA simply kind of rolled their request, suggestion, offer into this new strange idea that they've come up with. Again, like most of the strange ideas I've been hearing from them for the last year or so, I have this sense that it's going to go nowhere as well as the others. So yeah, I think it's interesting that they're informing us of all these great plans. Again, it sounds from the president's last tweet that this will be unnecessary and that, you know, we should forget about the moon in 2024 unless we get another tweet or something. I don't know. So I don't know. I tend to take NASA announcements with a grain of salt these days.
Yeah, every week it's something different. About a year ago, Russia wanted to separate some of its modules from the space station, create their own space station, because they knew that NASA wanted to deorbit their space station in 2024, and now that they're talking about 2028, and I don't know. There are, like I said, every week it's something different. This again is something new. Okay, back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. This is a strange time for NASA. I've always had a kind of problem with NASA in that it seems to be two bureaucracies in one. There's a highly respected scientific research bureaucracy, and then there's some kind of strange public relations company that's just out to kind of titillate and remind people its existence and plead for more money. It's a very schizophrenic organization from the outside looking in.
Okay, yeah, well, I guess that's the political part. They have to stir up emotions to try to get the public to pay for all this stuff. But yeah, the engineers and the scientists and all these companies that are involved, JPL and these people are dedicated. They have been since the beginning. But yeah, I'm going to be interested to see where this commercialization goes of the ISS. I know NASA doesn't want to continue to pay the $4 billion a year to maintain this thing once they feel they've done all the science they can. So they're going to try to, sublet this place. Sublet they actually consider it a national laboratory. So just like it was here on Earth. So they're going to try to rent it out, I guess. This is WS2N.
I just wonder if the small print in the lease agreement that we've signed will allow us to do these things. Again, the problem is that it's not owned by us. We have a portion of it, I guess, but the other countries have other portions of it, and we just can't use ours as we see fit, because we're all connected. That was sort of the idea way back. So again, I think this is just another random idea that erupted as a news, as a press release, and it'll go away like all the other press release announcements went.
Okay, well, if you're first for NASA, they haven't sent anybody up commercially. They've taken people from other countries and even politicians up, but no private person has paid NASA to go up there. The Russians have done it. I mean, they've done it like 9 times, you know. And we didn't seem to have a problem with that. They went up, they docked on their side of the space station, and they went along like that. They would go up for like 10 days and then come back, and they would pay, you know, $20-40 million. The price keeps going up. Right now, to send an American astronaut up, they're looking at $80 million, 80, and you just said something like $50 million if the private companies do it. So I guess you're going to need a lot of money, Roy, to do this.
I hope they don't call me up and ask me for it. There's a very good reason why we have not offered commercial flights to the ISS. We don't have a rocket ship that goes to the ISS. We have to buy a ride from the Russians. So, you know, once we get our act together and we get some kind of an engine that can take us there that isn't owned by the Russians, then I guess someone says, why not sell seats as well? I think that the Russian deals have kind of dried up, especially once they got into some trouble in previous flights that kind of caused these incredibly wealthy people who just wanted a ride up there to kind of look at their life insurance policies and decide to spend their money and their time elsewhere.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm thinking back with the space shuttles when they were going up. We sent up, there were about 37 flights that went up to the space station. So at that time, there were people that would have paid money, and NASA said, no way. You're not getting on here, especially after the Krista McCall Challenger disaster. I mean, even though that wasn't a private flight, it was still a private citizen, and they just ended any future commercialization after that. Until now, it looks like they're willing to take that step. The Russians have done it, you know, like with their Soyuz spacecraft. But when we were running the shuttle, they could have done it. John Devlin wanted to pay. He wanted to go to the Singer, and NASA said no, and then he was going to sign up with the Russians, and then he thought about it, and he declined that as well. Back to you, Rory.
I tend to think this is a money grab. This is a bunch of people who are looking at the budget, saying, how the heck are we going to pay the bills this week? And they're pulling the stops out, because that's sort of what the Russians did. They just saw it as a money-making proposition. We tend to have loftier ideas, and also the PR price. You know, the worst thing that could possibly happen is one of these jokers screw something up on the way up there and gets himself killed. You know, everyone's going to blame NASA, and it's going to just be a PR mess. So you got to factor in the risks and the benefits and the paycheck. And again, I could see the Russians doing it, because what the hell do they care? If you know, someone pays the money, I guess they pay it up front anyway. So if they die, they die. Here, we have less control over the press. We can't just kind of sink a story. So I don't know. I'm all for commercial businesses. I don't think that this is quite the place for it, in my own little opinion.
Yeah, very good. I agree. And you might hear me better now. I switch over to Selden. I was starting to lose you there. I think there's a band opening going on somewhere. between me and you, and we're going to have me say something has really dropped off on the Glen Oaks repeater. So, am I coming in better now, Roy?
Boy, you sound beautiful. I was hearing you very well on 2585 on the input. So you were getting to my house, but my house is only two-thirds of the way to the repeater. But now on the Eastern repeater, I think you sound great. Let's see what Roy thinks.
I agree. It's much clearer. There's a little bit of a background noise with the other repeater seen on people's transmissions, but you're sounding very good. Cool.
Okay, I'll leave it alone. We'll stick with this for now. All right, back to you, Roy.
Very good. If anyone has any other questions, feel free. Otherwise, I'll move on to the next story. In case you're getting a little annoyed by the strange spring that we've had this year, just be thankful you don't live in India. India was the hottest place in the world this past weekend. The northern state of Rajasthan was the epicenter of an extreme heat wave that very nearly broke all the all-time temperature records for India. A heat dome has been building over northern India for the past few days. Turning the region into a furnace. Numerous locations saw the mercury climb above 45 degrees Celsius. That's 113 degrees Fahrenheit here. On Saturday and Sunday, Truro, a city of 120,000 people sat at the epicenter of the heat wave. The temperature there reached 123 degrees Fahrenheit on Saturday. That puts it just a shade below the all-time temperature record for the entire country that was set in 2016 when it hit 123.8 degrees Fahrenheit in Palodi, another city in Rajasthan. With heat baking the region, the Indian Meteorological Department has issued a severe heat warning for Rajasthan and many neighboring states. So that includes Delhi, home of the Indian capital of New Delhi, where it reached temperature of 110.3 degrees Fahrenheit over the past weekend. According to the Meteorological Department, a severe heat wave warning means that extreme care is needed for vulnerable people. In a developing country like India, that includes not just the old, the sick, the young, but also millions of people who lack access to air conditioning, raising the risk of heat-related illnesses. India is no stranger to spring heat waves. Last year's heat waves were accompanied by deadly dust storms, while other recent May and early June hot spells have melted pavement. Rising temperatures, thanks to climate change, if you believe that, have helped boost the likelihood and the intensity of heat waves around the world. And the increasing scorching heat waves in India certainly fit with these patterns. Let me drop for a second and I'll be back. The extreme conditions are expected to ease as the week went on, and winds from the east usher in a comparatively cooler air. But it's far from the only meteorological malady affecting the country. The Indian monsoons is just around the corner, bringing quenching rains and lower temperatures, but the pre-monsoon season hasn't exactly been kind to India. The early season rains have, by and large, failed to materialize, according to the Times of India. This is the second driest pre-monsoon in 65 years of record-keeping. The AFP reports that 40% of the country is currently facing drought conditions. For a country where 60% of agriculture is rain-fed, the monsoon season is a make-or-break moment. The Indian Meteorological Department is forecasting a normal monsoon season, thankfully, but there's clearly some ground it'll have to make up for in an extremely hot, dry spring. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Roy, did they say how many people perished in that 123-degree temperature? And was that for a significant number of hours during the day? Not just no matter how short a time. Did they say how many people perished? I am guessing some number of people did perish in that temperature.
I'm pretty sure that there were people who perished in that temperature at much lower temperatures. I think it was last year in Chicago. There were a sizable number of people who died because of that. Unfortunately, the Indian press didn't publish that. I don't know if they've collected them yet, They do not have a great bureaucracy, so it could take probably weeks, if not months, for them to collate the statistics, and I'm not quite sure if they would share it with the world.
I'm going to say that anything above, say, 102 or so degrees Fahrenheit is a life-threatening temperature. If the core of your body goes above roughly 105 or 106, most people will go into convulsions at 107 core temperature. I think you're essentially dead. I think your brain and the nervous system essentially stops working. So if the outside temperature is 123, if you're not in an air-conditioned environment, you must be evaporating a calculatable amount of water continuously from your body to keep your core below, let me pick a number, 103 or so degrees Fahrenheit, in order to stay alive. Give us some comments on that one, Roy. Pass it over to Rich, and then I have another comment about the Whitney Houston situation. EC2GS, K2LIW.
Yeah, we have a narrow temperature range. We're warm-blooded creatures, but if you start to warm us too much, well, you can just take an egg and put it in a frying pan, and that's sort of what happens. You know, we've all kind of experienced fevers when we're 104 degrees. We're groggy. We don't really, our brain doesn't quite work right. If you get to things like 105, 106, most times people don't, but children... young children have been known to suffer brain damage, seizure disorder, and all manner of things due to high body temperature from fever. But you know, 123 is outrageous. You have to have a lot of evaporative cooling to keep your temperature certainly below 104. You'll become dehydrated. That's another set of problems. And basically, you cook like an omelet. So yeah, it's very problematic. We're not really designed for that type of temperature.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, thank you. I'm assuming that this is due to climate change. Some people don't believe in climate change. I do believe in it. And by the way, I once had a 105 fever a few years ago. I did not know it was 105. I was sick. And Patty called the Massapequa ambulance, volunteer ambulance. They took me to St. Joseph's of the hospital with a, they got me in, they gave me a lot of Tylenol. They kept taking my temperature. When they gave me a room, they told me I had 105 paranoid.
High temperature can be life-threatening. Again, especially young children are very sensitive to high temperatures. We're not designed for it. It's a curious evolutionary tendency that our immune system resets our temperature in our brain and our body to a higher one to fight the infection. Sometimes that's kind of a last-ditch effort that causes more problems than it solves. But on an evolutionary basis, I guess it has a effective increased survivability to do it that way. We take all these aspirins and Tylenols that artificially break that cycle of setting our temperature up at a higher rate. But like any warm-blooded animal, we are optimized for a very narrow range with thermal regulators and evaporative cooling. It doesn't beat air conditioning, unfortunately, and India doesn't have a lot of electricity and a lot of air-conditioned environment. So is it part of global climate change? My surmise is yes, but other people will say no, that weather is changeable. That sometimes things get hotter, sometimes things get colder, and it's not our fault. I think that's kind of the easy, lazy approach personally. I think more has to be done to kind of limit what we're doing to the atmosphere as far as carbon output and other things. But it's become a tribal political ball at this point. It's not a science, unfortunately. And things always get bad when science gets turned into politics.
I can't agree with you more, Roy. Eventually it's beginning to get so bad, it'll be undeniable. And then I'm afraid it'll be too late. You know, China is a big abuse. They're throwing tons of stuff into the atmosphere, and they don't seem to care. I really think we shouldn't deal with them at all.
And we don't have that choice of completely cutting ourselves off. If you set your hot tub to 107 degrees Fahrenheit, it would be uncomfortably warm, but it wouldn't burn you. You could climb into it. If you stayed there more than a few minutes, it could definitely become life-threatening. How hot can a human being tolerate? If I heated a chunk of steel to 150 degrees Fahrenheit, 150, and I placed it onto your hand, you could hold it continuously. It wouldn't be comfortable, but you wouldn't be saying, ouch, you wouldn't be blowing a blister. So water at 107 or so degrees Fahrenheit, you could climb into it, but boy, if you do, you better not stay there more than a few minutes. In the case of, let me drop them. In the case of Whitney Houston, she was in her bathtub, taking a leisurely hot tub-like bath in her hotel room. She probably was taking some alcohol and or some drugs at the time because she did fall asleep. She fell asleep, I think, this is a speculation on my part, while the hot water was coming out of the faucet at a trickle rate and the temperature of the water she was in was slowly rising. She passed away. I'm guessing that had they measured the temperature of the water she was in when they discovered her, they would have found out why. When it comes to doing the autopsy, they found no bruises, no cuts, no blunt trauma. So, I mean, why she died was probably not easy to find. But I think it was a hyperthermia situation because of a person not being conscious in water that's slowly rising in temperature because of the way the faucet was running. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2LIW.
I have a question for a moment, Dick.
Is that Joe? Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, do you hear another repeater on the output of 8-5? It sounds like something out there is running a carrier squelch, because it's almost taken out 8-5. Do you hear the same thing I'm listening to?
Very weakly, yes, I am hearing another. There's another repeater in New Jersey, Frenchtown, another repeater in Connecticut on this frequency. And when the propagation is right, we start hearing them. And that's what I think you're hearing, Joe. Go ahead.
And until we up.
Yeah, but I'm hearing you people key it up because it's got a different output PL on the instant than the output PL of this one. So everybody for the past 45 minutes has been keying up this machine and the other machine like its receiver out there is in carrier squelch. Kind of like odd, you know?
Understand. Go ahead, Rich.
Yes, Dick, I just want you to know, I got a catalog from TX Engineering. It's on the front cover, ICOM announced a radio called the IC9100. It's $1,900, it's multi-mode, sideband and everything, has T-SAR in it. And covers 2 meters, 432, and 1.2 gigahertz. I thought you'd like to know that. I'm probably going to be buying one.
It's a 9300, not a 9100.
Yes, it's a 9100. You're right.
Go ahead, Roy. Thank you for that information. You got it, Roy. But my point is be very careful about getting into hot water and think about the fact that your body must be evaporating water in order to stay cool in a hot environment. Those people who walk across the border between Mexico and the United States on a hot summer day, if they don't have a couple of gallons of water strapped to their body that they can be drinking while they go, the chances of surviving that trip where the soil and air temperature can get up to these numbers that are life-threatening without you evaporating a given amount of water from your body, you're going to become dehydrated, the temperature goes up, and you die. And it's really crazy when they put bottles of water out there to keep these people alive, and somebody doesn't agree that they should be allowed to come and then dumps out the water. You've probably seen some stories on the news about this. It's not a pleasant situation to talk about. Over to you, Roy, KQLIW.
Dick, humanity can be very inhumane, unfortunately. I don't know about the Whitney Houston situation. It could have been a hyperthermia. You have the complications of chronic drug abuse. All those things will have an effect as well. So you might not need the degree of hyperthermia that you would if she didn't have a lot of central nervous system depressants in her bloodstream to begin with. So it's a mess. I mean, the whole family, unfortunately, is a mess, and the daughter went soon after her, so it's a shame. But it could have been hyperthermia. Temperature regulation is incredibly important for warm-blooded creatures. Lizards and such can get by on a very wide range of temperatures. They're not designed with the close, high-efficient, but narrow, optimized range that hot-blooded animals are.
Next time on the question.
Yes, Rich.
ACQGS, WB2GXM. Roy, if the body gets overheated, would one of the symptoms manifest itself as a kind of weird kind of vision problem? Would you start seeing things akin to the tunnel in 2001 A Space Odyssey? You feel like you're going through that or looking like you're going through that? WB2GXM.
Yeah, I mean, basically you name it, and you probably have a case history for it. I mean, I'm sure you've had terrible high fevers where you were groggy and confused. I still remember when I was a kid, I had a terrible case of the flu with a high fever, and it was some weekend, and I thought I was watching Secret Agent Man on reruns on television, and I thought I was hallucinating. I later thankfully found out that it was actually The Prisoner, which had the same actor with almost the same premise, but a very strangely different concept. But yeah, you could have visual disturbance, you can have cognitive disturbance, you can have all kinds of things. Supposedly James Cameron had a high fever when he thought up the story for The Terminator. So I guess sometimes you could even channel creative energies into hyperthermia.
The reason I'm asking, I actually had something like this last week. I foolishly left my jacket on one of our hot days last week, and when I got to work, I sat down and I started to sort of see these shadows kind of swimming around, and I was just sitting there for an hour trying to get used to this, trying to work through it. And I love The Prisoner. Thank you for mentioning that. The prisoner is like a religion. WBTGXM.
That Patrick McGoohan was an awful good actor.
I agree with both of you. I learned to love The Prisoner, but you got to realize, I think when I first saw it, I was about 12 years old, maybe, with a high fever. I thought I was watching Secret Agent Man, and it was very confusing at the time. So I was really worried that my brain had broke.
And to you.
Do you have any history of migraines? Because migraines can present with that type of a visual disturbance.
I have them very, very occasionally. I don't have a history of constant migraines, so I would rule that out. WB2GXM.
Tuio.
And Tuio, we'll get to you in a second. I'm just thinking at the top of my head. I mean, unless you happen to have a high fever at the time that you had the visual disturbances, it's still a possibility if you do have any history of migraines. It doesn't have to be chronic, constant migraines. Some people never get those prodromes, those visual disturbances. Others only get the visual disturbance without the migraine headaches themselves. I have had them. I unfortunately have migraine headaches, and I've had episodes where I will have visual disturbances. I will lose my peripheral vision for about 20, 30, 40 minutes, and I don't actually get the associated migraine with it. I've had other times where I get the migraine and I don't get the visual perceptions. But it sounds a little bit more like that than a febrile episode, unless you haven't mentioned that you were running a temperature at the time.
Temperature.
Now, say again?
I was not running a temperature at the time, thanks.
Okay, so I don't know for a fact what it is, but one of the differential diagnoses can be the prodrome of a migraine headache.
All right, thank you, Roy. I will pay more attention to watching at about temperature anyway. And I'll be watching about that. Thanks for bringing this up. ACTGSWVTGXM.
Hey, very good, Rich. N2EO, you wanted to say something?
Yes, Roy. When I have that 105 fever, how do you explain, if you can, why I didn't have visual effects or anything? Like I said, I was taken to the hospital because I just felt I didn't feel right. Apparently they took my vitals, it must have been the ambulance, because they went with Simons. They took me to St. Joe, and the team was all prepared for me.
Well, Rich, different people respond to different situations as far as temperatures. Some people, again, children more likely than adults, will have violent seizures. Tonic-clonic seizures are very common with high temperature fever of young children. You just might have different symptoms where you might have been a little bit confused, a little bit forgetful. Your memory doesn't quite work that well. You don't quite remember the accurate details or something, but you didn't have any kind of visual disturbance or anything that was memorable to you. It's a mixed thing. It's kind of like if you throw a wrench into a piece of equipment, it doesn't necessarily break down in the same way for every piece of equipment.
That's quite true, boy. Do you know back when I was a kid? I must have been around maybe 12, 11. I had a high fever. My mother was in the room. And, you know, they talk about after death. I knew nothing about it. Never knew it existed. But I remember being pulled up in a tube to the moon. It must have been a light. In those days, I had no knowledge of that. So I thought it was being pulled up to the moon. I don't know why.
Well, Rich, a lot of people have written up a lot of cases of near-death experiences and similar types of things. They've made movies about the subject. The problem is it's very difficult to kind of remove that from the way people's brain works, to the point where if you induce a strong magnetic, electromagnetic field in certain areas of your brain, they can actually manipulate it to the point of they can induce a very similar sensation. They call it a God helmet. You get the sense of a presence and the bright light and the out-of-body experience. So it's sort of difficult to remove your brain from your conscious thought. That's always the problem, but everyone is free to believe what they wish to believe.
Oh, I know I experienced it. I'd never heard of it. I just remember now, years later, that I had that. So it's not suggestive at the time. It's just stuck in my memory.
BCH with a question.
I think we should be a little bit careful here, Roy. I know that the rules of this repeater is that we're not supposed to discuss medical things, and we're getting awfully close to it. The new person, go ahead.
Okay, I just had a quick question about thermal response of the eye. The fact that the eye doesn't have any thermal sensors in it as the body heats up, I was wondering how that could affect the response of the visual responses of how heat would affect you. And yes, I did love The Prisoner. In some ways, The Prisoner was a sequel to Secret Agent. Anyway, go ahead. I agree entirely about The Prisoner, but the problem was it was kind of a it took it to a kind of a right angle. It was, you know, if you were kind of used to Secret Agent Man, it was a pretty standard spy a show, and this was not a standard show by any stretch of the imagination. But as you say, the thermal regulation is probably worse, and Dick has discussed this with radio frequency producing heat, ocular heat. Most of our heat dissipation is usually treated by a vast vascular system with fluid running right. You know, we have a liquid cooling system. Like some expensive personal computers. And the blood streams through different areas and soaks up the heat, takes it to one of the largest organs in our body, our skin, vasodilates, and puts a lot of surface area between blood vessels and the skin and dissipates the heat through radiative and evaporative processes. And in the eye, you don't really see that. It's a closed space. The best that you could offer is some slight retinal temperature regulation from the retinal artery and veins, but that's not as good. So my guess is it's a little sturdier than other organs, less likely to immediately fail the functional constraints, but it's probably in the long run very problematic.
D2NBB, get a comment.
Comment away.
Actually, it's kind of a question. I just have a memory, a very clear memory of being, I was either 5 or 6 years old, and to me it was just another time of being sick. When you're that age, you get sick not so rarely. And I went into the clinic, the doctor's office, and they took my temperature and said it was 105. My memory was that I was not that seriously ill. I think I just went home and got better, so it's very interesting. So, is it possible to have like 105 for a short time and it not be too serious?
Again, your mileage might vary. Usually when you get past 104, that never leads to anything good. 106 is compatible with seizure disorders and all kinds of organ failure and such. 105, there's also a little variation in the accuracy of a lot of measuring devices, so you're never quite sure whether it was 105 or 104.6 or 104.7 rounded up or something. Theoretically, it's possible, especially when you're young and you're healthy and you're well hydrated and you don't have any other problems. If you tack on 105 for a short period of time, you can get away with things like that. So that's a possibility. I don't think that would count as a miracle, if you will.
Thank you, Roy. I had that memory for years until I heard that people talking about how serious that temperature was. And, yeah, it's interesting. Like you say, they could have read it wrong. Although it was the doctor who told me this. So anyway, back to Ned. Thanks. Thanks for the answer.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, Roy, is that some people will get quite seriously ill at 105, and some people it's not so bad. But plus or minus 1 degree from there, things can start happening awfully fast, I believe. You got it, Roy. KQLIW.
Net.
I agree with you, Dick. It depends upon people. Some people are just stronger and more tolerant. You can smack them around a little bit more before it becomes a problem. So if you have someone with a series of underlying problems and they're sitting, you know, 3 inches away from the cliff, any little tap in the wrong direction and they fall off the cliff. So, again, if you're relatively healthy, if you're not suffering from any kind of chronic problems, if this isn't a systemic, massive infectious process going on, human beings are very tolerant of things. They can bounce back, fortunately. Right. This has been fun, but it's now 11:01, so it's time for Space Report. Once again, just want to remind everyone, I was going to do a little thing on the Navy and UFOs. Hopefully I'll get to it next week. I'm sorry that I wasn't able to get to it this week. Anyway, if you have any topics, if you have any questions or answers or statements or refutations, the address is mailbag@ac2gs. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And its links for all the stories that I tell you will be available at roy.ac2gs.com. So I want to thank everyone who participated tonight, and Dick and Paul, and take it away, Dick.
Yeah, we did have a good deal of participation tonight. That's good. Hope you do next week also. Paul, tell us what's going on with NASA. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, this is WS2N, and yeah, we'll cover NASA, we'll cover the Russians. For instance, you have a Russian rocket that's going to be going up on the 21st of this month, and it's going to have an X-ray observatory on board. They're calling it Spectre RG. Now, it's an upgraded version of something that they put up in the 1990s. And this thing's supposed to be 25 times more sensitive than the previous X-ray observatory. And they think they're going to find all kinds of new galaxies and cluster galaxies and things like that with this. They call it a medium X-ray band, 10 kilo electro volts and energy, kilovolts, 10 kilovolts energy. So, you know, I'm just beside myself. Why they need this? What this is going to do different? And I sent the message to Roy. Maybe he would know. What's the advantage of an X-ray band telescope compared to? Let's say the infrared ones that James Webb is going to be. Now, this thing's going to be going out to the Lagrange Point 2, out where James Webb will be. Being launched on a Proton rocket, that's a Russian rocket. And the instruments that are on board that's going to be looking at this, these galaxies, are made by, you know, made in Germany. And they have about 50 or so coated gold mirrors inside, and then that's all beamed down to a charge couple device for sending the information back. But maybe Roy, what's the advantage of using this X-ray system? I know we have the Chandra X-ray telescope, but you know, when you think about it, what? Why do they need that? What are they going to see that's different, and why? Back to you, Dick, or anybody else.
K2GS? X-rays is a different range. We look in the radio waves, we look at the infrared, we look at the optical, and X-rays is a different imaging technology that shows us different emissions. Supposedly, they're hoping to be able to observe, they say, more than 3 million active black holes at the centers of different galaxies. So I think that's the primary thing that they're hoping for. But if they find other bodies that are emitting high-energy X-rays, that will be new discoveries available. So I think that's what's going on.
Yeah, I was backed away from the rig, so I'm sorry. Every so often, NASA will show you a composite picture. Well, they'll have three pictures side by side of the exact same celestial object. One is with near-infrared, far-infrared, visual, ultraviolet, and so on. And whatever object you're looking at, for instance, a nebula, they look very different. The different portions glow at different temperatures, and therefore what wavelength you use to observe it. Gives you more information. There's many kinds of astronomy. There's optical astronomy, radio astronomy. I mean, the radio signal gives you a very different picture. Higher or lower resolution, different penetration of the... let me drop the...
There's been some delays. Originally going to go up on a proton.